You've got to get to the cloud. It's a moral imperative, or well, at least it's a corporate directive. And on the way, you'd like to embrace stuff like infrastructure as code, DevOps, and serverless. You know, all the cool buzzwords you've heard being thrown around at your local user group or community event. But how do you actually approach integrating these amazing technologies into your day-to-day workflow? How do you create an initial environment, and how do you update that environment after day one? What was that glowing thing in the briefcase from Pulp Fiction? We'll try to get to the bottom of some of these questions on today's episode. Welcome to Day 2 Cloud, a frank discussion of what happens when cloud stops being polite and starts getting real. This is episode 14, and I'm your host, Ned Bellavance, Ned1313 on the Twitters. Today, I'm joined by DevOps engineer, Mr. Mark Gosa. Welcome to the show, Mark. So, first question, what exactly is a DevOps engineer?
Okay, so, well, my actual title at work is infrastructure engineering lead.
Oh, okay.
Because we decided actually that there's no such thing as a DevOps engineer. DevOps isn't something you actually do. So, but we work in the DevOps method. We use those methodologies, those principles, but we don't actually have any DevOps engineers.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because it's a word that you hear thrown around a lot, DevOps, and everybody has their own spin on what that means. But it's interesting you say DevOps is not it's not a title necessarily. It's more of something, a process that you follow. Is that, would that be a fair way of characterizing it?
Yeah, exactly. I think it causes some confusion when we have new people join and they're asking, where's the DevOps team? And we'd explain that actually the infrastructure engineers are the DevOps, they're working in the DevOps way.
Right.
But it's more of how you have, you're looking at things like fail fast, you're looking at pipelines, automation, you've got a cross-functional team. You know, with security, you've got developers, testers, and infrastructure engineers all together, product owner, Scrum Master as well. So that's how we're working, really.
Okay. And are you also working using the Agile foundation, so doing sort of sprints and epics and those types of ideas?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we have a product owner who's in sprint as well. And we've got two weekly sprints. Every day we've got a morning stand-up, and then we've got refinements and planning sessions and retrospectives as well every 2 weeks.
Okay. So in your notes, you'd mentioned before you joined the company you're currently working for, they received instructions that they had to start using cloud technologies. And I guess they sort of jumped in to using the cloud. So what was sort of the process and methodology for that initial cloud adoption and planning?
Yeah, so the way it worked was there's a large infrastructure team, but not everyone knew cloud, and I think they found it was very hard to mobilize that team, and so they basically they hired in a few additional engineers, and made a small cloud team, which then kind of was separate from the rest of infrastructure engineering, so they could do things that were not done in the business before. They were a lot smaller, could move a lot faster. And everything was done manually as well.
Okay. So they weren't using automation right from the get-go. It was, set things up manually first. Was that intentional, or they just weren't sure how to deploy the automation components at first?
Yeah, so I think it was they didn't know how to do automation at that time. Didn't know which tools, and actually how do you do an end-to-end web solution. Yeah, so it was all done manually. And I think when you do things manually, you lose that consistency. You've got different naming conventions.
Right, sure. I mean, it's a lot harder to enforce standardization when people are, just kind of clicking through. And maybe if they're just had a big lunch and they're feeling a little tired, they forget to fill out a field correctly or add a tag. That sort of stuff happens.
yeah, definitely.
So, what was, were they deploying against Azure, AWS? Was it a combination of the two?
So we're an Azure house, so okay. Everything's in Azure.
And that initial deployment, was there a lot of planning in terms of, how do we want to lay out subscriptions and resource groups and role-based access control? Or was that something that's kind of figured out later?
Yeah, that's figured out later. So I think what was done was there were a few different subscriptions, and there are many ways you can do it. But we had one for IaaS, one for PaaS, one for production, one for production IaaS and one for production PaaS, one for dev IaaS and dev PaaS. But then it gets a bit confusing because for some PaaS solutions, you sometimes do need a virtual machine in there for AD or DNS or something.
Sure.
So now does that go in the other subscription and then you peer the VNets or so that you can have like a purely PaaS subscription. So it got very confusing.
Right. So to pick that apart a little bit, because not everyone might be familiar with the virtual networking and, you know, separation of subscriptions. So you can't have resources from two different subscriptions in the same VNet, right? If I got resources in the PaaS subscription you're talking about and resources in an IaaS subscription, I don't think those can't be in the same virtual network, right? That's why you had to do the peering.
That's why. Yeah. I think even it might have the networking is very confusing. It might actually be routing through a gateway, which is it has an express route to on-prem. It might actually be going through on-prem, but it's we decided not to to talk about that too much.
The interesting thing about like the PaaS services is a lot of them until very recently lived outside of the virtual networking, so they were using public endpoints essentially. So if you're routing all of your VNet traffic for the IaaS stuff back down to on-prem, then it's kind of going all the way down to on-prem and then shooting back out through your public internet connection to get to the PaaS services.
Yeah, potentially.
Hopefully not, but sometimes that can happen. Mm. I know they've made some changes recently, at least Azure has, to create VNet endpoints for a lot of the PaaS services. So you can now put that service in a VNet and then pair the VNet to something else so it doesn't have to make that sort of big trombone for networking. That's we can go really far down the networking rabbit hole, but that's I don't think that's the topic for today. Okay, so you had these subscriptions set up and you started deploying resources. Overall, what sort of services and resources were you deploying into these subscriptions?
Okay, so we have some internet-facing applications and things like for the mobile app and for customer portals and that sort of thing. But also we had a lot of IaaS as well. So we've got domain controllers, HR applications. I think there's a new finance one that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
So a huge mix. A bit of a mix of pure serverless, actual PaaS and IaaS.
And how did you make a determination, like which things would go IaaS and which things would go to PaaS?
Okay, so I think it was a bit before I joined, but I think if something was predominantly PaaS, it would go into the PaaS subscription.
Okay,
and then IaaS, but it does get it's a bit of a gray area because actually part of the infrastructure I've inherited is mostly PaaS, but there are still some Linux VMs in there. But it's in the same subscription.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even though it was supposed to be separated, it turned out not to be.
Yeah, I think it was. I'm not sure if it really works that way, where you can separate by resource type. I think it's far better to do by sort of environment and business units. It could be like commercial engineering or operations engineering. They each have their own set of subscriptions, and each one of them has, you know, a dev subscription and a prod subscription. It could be they also have a staging or something else, but at least some sort of prod and non-prod.
Yeah, so I imagine once you came on board, you started making some suggestions and modifications. So did you start implementing automation right away, or was it more like, let's get the subscriptions and like the governance nailed down?
Yeah, so actually they both happened at the same time.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So we deployed a new stamp, so a new subscription sort of pattern for the business, and then started looking at things like Terraform and Ansible and how do we orchestrate this all and create some pipelines with Azure Pipelines.
Ooh, okay, you said a lot of fun terms there. Let's unpack a few of those. So what components were you using Terraform to deploy?
So at the moment, we're using Terraform to deploy the everything we need in the environment. So it would be, it could be that it's an IaaS solution where you've got a few virtual machines, load balancer. Could be that it's more of a PaaS solution where it's a number of different, so it could be an app, a few app gateways, a couple of web apps, could be an ASC as well. And then we've got some of the newer solutions now are mostly serverless. So lots of Azure functions and API management and that sort of thing. And there are some limitations to Terraform in that it doesn't have a resource for everything you want to deploy. Sometimes you do have to fall back onto things like Chrome templates.
So I'm curious, have you used the pattern where you generate an ARM template using the Terraform resource, or are you just creating an ARM template and using it straight away as opposed to trying to keep that in the Terraform world?
Yes. So we are trying to go Terraform. So anything that we can't do would probably be an ARM template in Terraform.
Okay.
So you still have the same sort of way of managing it, the same sort of pipeline, and you don't need to add additional tasks to run ARM templates. And it also gets, it's also a bit easier when you need to pass parameters from Terraform into your ARM template. If there's separate tasks in Azure DevOps, then there's something you can do in that you can basically get Terraform to call a PowerShell script, which then writes a variable into Azure DevOps. And then if Azure DevOps passes that on the as a parameter to your ARM template. But it's sort of getting a little bit on the, this is a bit much. So, yeah.
Sure. So today you started, Terraform is something that you're invoking through an Azure pipeline.
Yeah.
And so I guess we can go into Terraform in a little more detail. And for listeners who aren't very familiar with Terraform, I definitely encourage them to go, listen to a previous podcast that I did with the Datanauts, or if you have a resource you'd recommend listeners checking out, whether you have a talk or something that they might want to look at.
Matter of fact, I do. So actually, I spoke at the Hashi Talks event on Thursday, Friday. So it's a 24-hour event. And yeah, so actually I did a demo of how you can deploy an API on, so a .NET Core API on an Azure Function app. So it includes storage account, app service plan, function app, and resource group.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It was very cool. And actually, I mean, when you start doing it, it actually is very quick. So the actual deployment took, I think, 4 minutes in the demo. And when you think back to how we would do that on-prem, you have number of virtual machines and load balancers. If you wanted to auto-scale, then how do you auto-scale a VM if it's on VMware? Probably can with a lot of PowerShell and Terraform or whatever, but this way we don't have to think about it. It's great. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I'll include a link to your talk as well as that one Datanauts episode if people kind of want to get up to speed on Terraform. But I'm curious because I have some questions about like the initial deployment and how you're integrating it with Azure pipelines and DevOps. When you need to store state for Terraform for your various deployments, what's sort of your approach to the state file? Are you doing one state file per environment? And where are you storing those state files?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So Terraform is different to ARM templates in that you do need a state file. It does that for performance reasons, and Terraform needs to keep a local record of what it's deployed, because you can also run Terraform destroy, which will look at what it's deployed and then destroy all those things.
Yes.
So, yes. it sounds like
user beware.
Yes, definitely. That state file is pretty important. So you want to keep it somewhere safe, so not on your local machine. So, for example, but the other thing is, if you've got you could have multiple deployments to the same environment at the same time, then you need a way to have that state file in the central place so other people can consume it. But also, when a Terraform configuration's running, it will lock the state file, so no one else can also run a configuration. Because otherwise you're going to get some very interesting things happening there. things I don't want to know about, really. But yeah, so we decided, so we put it in Azure storage accounts, blob storage, and yeah, okay. We have one per environment per product. So it could be we've got a new website for customers to apply for various things. So dev, test, and prod environment. And each one of those has its own state file.
Okay. I know one of the things that you can do with state files is you can have one configuration reference the state file for another environment. So do you have like a shared services environment that you're referencing the state file for that in these individual deployments, or you try to keep everything very like isolated in its own world?
Do you mean, do we have a Terraform state file storage account and then multiple containers and
well, I was more curious, like a lot of times you'll have a shared services environment where you've got your domain controllers or some other component that, you know, your application might need to talk to. Are you pulling information about those environments in when you're building your config, or are you trying to keep every environment and I guess deployment very isolated in terms of the state?
Yeah, so they are generally isolated. It might be that we need to pass the IPs of the domain controllers just for DNS. Generally, we don't have much cross-project communication. Okay. So, because security is quite high, they're actually they require things to be isolated in case, you know, something's compromised. You don't want it to kind of jump sideways, as well as go further down deeper into your infrastructure.
Sure. Yeah. And then in terms of the, I guess the other question that you were kind of answering for me was where you're storing those state files. Is it like one state file per container per storage account, or sort of what's the structure that you put together for that?
At the moment, we have one storage account for per team, and then in there you have a container for each project, and then you've got a state file for each environment.
Okay.
So you'd have sort of a dev, test, and prod state file all in the same container for that project.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it means that we're not redeploying, we're not deploying storage accounts left, right, and center. And also, what comes first? I mean, can you deploy a storage account with Terraform, which you then use to put your state file in?
Some sort of exception.
I don't think it's. Yeah, it's pre-Terraform, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing I've encountered is either to have a standalone Terraform config that uses a local state file just to get that initial storage account and a couple things up, or just do it through the portal or an ARM template, and then kind of get your Terraform going after that.
Yeah, and there's something new that's come out. That's Azure Blueprints. I think that's might still be in preview, but it's a way for you to sort of define all your subscriptions, and then you apply your blueprint on top, which basically says it basically applies your RBAC, your Azure policies, and can also deploy some ARM templates. So those can be sort of your core networking, your VNets, and it's got another cool feature where actually, even if you give that team owner rights on a resource group, you can set it to lock particular resources in that group. So even the owner can't delete the VNet, which you've deployed through the Azure Blueprint.
Oh, that's tremendously useful. It might not seem like it at first, but it's the scenarios that I've dealt with. Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. And like if we had that like a year ago, that'd be great. Yeah, but I mean, once you've got your environment deployed, it's very hard to now just apply a blueprint on top.
Sure. So in terms of your pipeline, when you're doing a Terraform deployment, do you go through the plan process first and then have like a manual gate where someone reviews the plan before it applies, or sort of what's your workflow for getting a Terraform configuration from checking it in to actually having it roll out?
Yeah, so there's a three commands in Terraform. There's a Terraform init, plan, and apply. And so init just downloads the various plugins it needs, and it can also download any modules you might be referencing. And then plan would actually go through what your configuration does and actually work out what it needs to to deploy. So look at your current environment. It might be that you've got 4 virtual machines, but your configuration's got 6. So then the plan will basically say, need to create another 2 virtual machines. However, the reason Terraform is pretty good is that it's good to see what it's going to do. So it might be that actually you've done a mistake in your Terraform and it actually wants to delete those 4 virtual machines because you've renamed them. And so it's good to check that plan. So I was in 2 minds as to whether we should kind of pause it there, get someone to manually check it, and then run the apply. I thought that's adding a manual step, which isn't pretty.
Sure.
And there was another thing that we tried, which was to wrap the Terraform plan in PowerShell, and you get PowerShell to run it, go have a look at the plan, and if it says it's going to destroy something, fail that step. And then you can go into Azure, you can go to Azure Pipelines and override it, you pass the PowerShell script to a loudest way parameter, and then it can go and do it. I thought, okay, that feels a bit safer, but it's not very pretty when you see random failures in your deployment history. But then I think the last one we've settled on is if you've got a good testing environment, so you've got dev, test, and prod, if it does accidentally destroy something in dev, it's fine-ish. Developers might not be so happy, but you would know what it's going to do before it goes into test and then prod.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, so you're sort of using your dev as was and test as was intended to see how what happens when you make that action before you roll it out to production. Then you're feeling pretty confident when it hits production that it's going to do exactly what it did in dev and test and any other environments.
Yeah, so it's almost like you're treating the Terraform code as you would the application code. Because you do the same sort of thing for application code.
Right. So in that regard, I assume you're using, Visual Studio Code or something similar to make updates, and then you're checking it into some sort of source control. Does that, when you commit something, does that automatically kick off the pipeline workflow, or are there more steps in that process that you've put in place?
Yeah, so VS Code is my go-to for everything, apart from actually .NET, which I prefer Visual Studio for. Don't know why, it's probably just how I started out in .NET. So you commit and push to your feature branch, we then have a pull request into develop. And then once it's into develop, then on pull request, it'll run a test build. If that passes, then it will allow you to complete the pull request. And then we've got continuous integration enabled, so it'll automatically kick off a build. And then we've got continuous deployment enabled on the release pipeline to deploy it into the develop environment. But for test, I think it's probably the way we work. I think so we've got approval before test. I think that's just more to just notify the test engineers that, we've made a change. If you're running continuous test, then you might want to finish that test first, and then we'll swap it over. Otherwise, they're going to find that, certain tests weren't failing for the first half, and then it started failing.
Something somewhere changed. It was, yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, and then into prods, again, we've got, Azure DevOps is very flexible because, for example, some projects we actually need a legal sign-off and then a marketing sign-off.
Oh.
So actually we can integrate that all into that pipeline.
Okay. So yeah, you can put those gates in there where they have to sign off.
Yeah, so when it's deployed into test, for example, you can have them actually go and check the website. And if they're happy with everything, then they can sign off into prod or into staging or whatever the next environment is.
Another issue that I've seen arise with Terraform running is if somebody goes and makes a change to the environment outside of Terraform, now what Terraform has in its state file and the reality aren't the same, which causes everyone a lot of heartburn. So have you run into that issue? Have you put like safeguards in place to prevent that?
So I ran into that issue. You find that Terraform is like you've just done a deployment, and then a bit later you do the same deployment and it says it's going to change something. And you wonder, okay, how's it doing that? Then realize someone's changed something and it's just changing it back to what it should be. But it can get a bit more complicated when, let's say, someone's added a new resource to that resource group. Terraform has no idea that it's there.
Right.
I think it generally ignores it. So you think that your infrastructure matches your code, and then you go and find actually there's a new load balancer and you don't know how they got there. So in order to try and reduce that, what we're trying to do at the moment is actually only provide read access to the subscription. And that sounds great in principle, but then you have to think about things like what happens if I just need to restart a web app. I can't do that with read access. Right. So there are things like privileged identity manager, so PIM, and you can allow mm-hmm. people to increase their privileges in order to do certain things. And it's time-based, and you can add approvals in. And you can also require them to provide the ticket number or something. So you've got that audit trail.
Right. So in case of emergency, they can break glass and do what they need to do. But otherwise, they're following the principles that you've already laid down and doing everything through, you know, Terraform or whatever your deployment mechanism is.
Yeah, and that gives you one pane of glass. So if you want to know what happened to your infrastructure, all the way from code commit and also any linked work items in the pull request, you can see it all the way through, which is one great thing about using Azure DevOps end-to-end. Mm-hmm. You don't suddenly jump into Octopus or into TeamCity or something else.
It's funny you should mention those two. That's the two tool sets I'm very familiar with. So. Interesting. So I'm curious, one thing that you mentioned way back was that you're also using Ansible for some of your deployment process. So where do you kind of let Terraform stop and Ansible start in that deployment process?
Yeah, interesting question. So we were talking about this just recently, actually. You've got two separate things, but there's a little gray area in between. So you've got infrastructure management and configuration management. And then
sure,
infrastructure would be sort of standing up the networks, the virtual machines, up to a point where you're now into the OS, when I think that's where configuration management would take over. And thing is, you can use Terraform as an infrastructure tool to deploy configurations, because it's got some, I think, remote exec feature where you can run something in the guest. And if you really wanted, you can get Ansible. You can use the Ansible Azure modules to deploy Azure resources. And it can get even more confusing in that you can get Terraform to run a command line tool such as Ansible and then get that to do your configuration management, or you could get Ansible to run Terraform. So what's happening these days, I think, is everything can kind of do everything. I had an interesting chat the other day about PowerShell. I mean, we could stand up Azure resources, we can deploy configurations, you run PowerShell Linux, you can integrate with REST APIs, you can do everything with PowerShell. But the question is, should you? There are other tools that do things better. So I think Terraform is better place for standing up infrastructure in Azure. And once you have a working OS, you can get Ansible to connect in over WinRM Remote PowerShell and do that. But there's an interesting thing when you do this, in that once you stand up a virtual machine, Ansible can't connect to it because it doesn't have the right Remote PowerShell settings.
Okay.
So actually what we had to do was we had to get Terraform to actually run a VM extension, which runs a PowerShell script inside the guest. And that configures the remote PowerShell for Ansible. And then it's good to go from there.
Right, yes. Because out of the box, are you using the marketplace images when you're doing the deployment?
Yeah, these are marketplace ones.
Okay, yeah. So they don't have the proper ports open and ready to go for Ansible to connect in on WinRM, right? Mm. Yeah, so yeah, I got to do that remote exec or the VM extension is different than remote exec, but you got to have that VM extension run that little PowerShell script to get it prepped and ready to go. And then how does Ansible get notified that it's Ansible's turn to do something with that virtual machine when Terraform's done?
Yeah, so put them in the same release, in the same pipeline. So actually, once Terraform task is completed, then Ansible can connect in. But they have to be wary in that. I think we found a problem where Ansible was trying to connect and the VM was just completing a final restart after Terraform did its thing. Because I think we modified that script so that it actually installs the latest version of PowerShell and then restarts. So when Ansible comes to connect, it's okay. You know, it can't connect. It tries once or twice and then gives up. So actually, there's some settings in Ansible. You can say, keep attempting for 10 minutes, try every 30 seconds, and that works fine.
Right, put some timeouts in there that, you know, it won't just give up right away.
Yeah,
that
exactly. Makes... yeah, but we are finding like there's a good few challenges when you've got Terraform in the mix, you've got Ansible in the mix, you've got PowerShell DSC probably integrating with Ansible, and then you're trying to glue this all together with an Azure pipeline, and it's throwing variables left, right, and center, and you got PowerShell also as that glue between different steps. So
right.
I think these days it's very important to be able to pick up new skills, new languages very quickly and sort of try not to get too confused about, you know, how do I loop through an array in PowerShell compared to Terraform, compared to .NET, compared to Ansible and YAML. So
the list just goes on,
and then you need to think about things I'm not too familiar with, it's sort of automated testing for Terraform, unit testing in Terraform. So it might be something else we have to learn, like Kitchen Terraform or TerraTest, but I still need to research these things. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. And I don't know how far you've gone down that, because I know, like, when it comes to PowerShell, unit testing usually use something like Pester.
Yep.
And then if you're using unit testing for, I guess, .NET Core, it has its own unit testing framework that you can use. Is there a unit testing framework for Terraform?
I think there's something written in Go.
Okay.
There is some. Yeah, I'm still researching it. It'd be good to have.
Yeah.
But I think also the integration testing is also very useful, because you can have something that looks fine in Terraform and it looks great in VS Code, no errors anywhere. But when you run it, when you actually go to deploy it, it's not what you expected, or it's or the application gateway says my subnet doesn't exist, and you go and have a look. Actually, the subnet does exist, but at the time it was deploying the app gateway, the subnet didn't exist. So it wasn't lying, but it just didn't know the app gateway depended on the subnet. So you have to create these dependencies in Terraform, which VS Code won't tell you about.
Right, right. It has no way of knowing that the two separate resources are related in some way. So you need that integration testing to just kind of discover that.
Yeah, yeah. And if your module can do many things, then you want to deploy each one of those possibilities out and then run some tests to make sure that actually your module does work.
Mm-hmm.
It could work for you in your particular environment. And when someone else uses it and uses particular settings, then it doesn't work for them. So, yeah.
Right. I ran into a very interesting configuration issue with Terraform. I was trying to deploy out a virtual network gateway with a public IP and then get that public IP and feed it into something else to create a VPN tunnel. And for whatever reason, the first time I'd run Terraform apply, it would never find that public IP address. It would always come up as a null value. But if I let the apply finish, because, you know, it doesn't delete all the resources, it leaves what it successfully deployed, ran another plan and apply, it grabbed the public IP address and finished the configuration, no problem.
Huh.
And I tried adding depends on in different places and putting one thing into a module, and I could never get it to work.
Yeah, I think that was a dynamic IP, right?
It was a dynamic IP, and so it's assigned once the resource is up. And of course, virtual network gateways take forever to come up. And it was just one of those things where I think maybe that resource needs to be rewritten a little bit to better accommodate the reality of how the resource is deployed. That's like way above my level of programming and Go.
Yeah, likewise. I think my colleagues got the same problem, but it's with an app gateway and a dynamic IP.
Yeah, so frustrating. I'm like, just work.
Yeah, I was telling him, why didn't you get create a null resource in Terraform to run a PowerShell script that keeps trying to query this public IP and get that to depend on the app gateway. So Terraform would go in, create your public IP. It's got no IP on it. It goes in and creates your app gateway and then links the two. And when the app gateway is done, it runs its PowerShell script to just sit there waiting for the public IP and then eventually get it and output it to somewhere useful and do that. But it's not pretty.
No, it's not pretty. I could have used that like 3 months ago, though. Where were you, Mark?
In London.
Fair enough. All right. So I think we're coming up to about time for the podcast. Before we wrap up, I'm wondering if you could kind of distill our conversation down a little bit to some key takeaways for listeners. What are a few key takeaways that you think listeners could glean from this episode?
Yes. So I think when people are starting out with the cloud, it's great to test things and just throw things together and make them work. But I think before they go into production, there has to be a bit of thought about, you know, how do we control, how do we have governance here? Do we need Azure policies? What's our RBAC model look like? What's our subscription model look like? How's our networking fit together on sort of the larger scale, the more long-term? Because when I think the more that you sit in cloud day one, the more technical debt you are making for yourself when it gets to cloud day two. Because at one point you're going to have to migrate these things over to a new subscription. The more stuff you have, then the more work you have to do. And it's work that you can.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got this long-term thinking, if you've got that long-term thinking mindset, then you can reduce the amount of work. Although it does take longer to deploy the initial production environment, you should be able to get some benefit back when you do that. Like you only have to deploy it once. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great.
And then there's lots of stuff around. Lots of stuff around all the tools that you have to learn, and it's good to make a decision on actually which tools. Otherwise, you're sort of jumping between different tools, and they can all do everything. And there's lots of different languages to learn and things, but. Yeah, I think the quicker you sort of define exactly what you are going to do going forward, the less work you have to redo later.
All right. Good stuff. If people want to know more about you, where can they find you? Where can they follow you?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter, so you can just follow me. It's Mark Gosser. I also have a blog as well, so it's markgosser.blogspot.com.
Okay, great. And I will include all of that in the show notes. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us on the Day 2 Cloud podcast. I had a great time.
Yeah, likewise. It was good being here. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Sure. Thank you to Mark for appearing on Day 2 Cloud. And thanks to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you like the show, please subscribe and let me know on Twitter. If you have suggestions for future shows, then I'd love to hear them. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.